When you're shut, what does it actually feel like?
I was just floored. I was wiped out. There's one in the ankle, there's one in the calf. Time does slow down a little bit. I need to get into cover because if this guy then comes out of the cave, he potentially could kind of take my life. The pain in my hip was crazy. Rounds firing, IEDs, explosions. I do remember thinking, I can't go out this way. I mean, I can't do this to Irene. This is mental.
Was there then a mental struggle when you realised Christmas Day, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to go back to that again?
I knew my career was over. I genuinely didn't know what to do. It was more about how the hell do I pay this mortgage now?
What's one thing that you think civilians just wouldn't understand?
There's so many people that are suffering, and I will go into a statistic that will blow your mind. That time frame from when 9/11 happened to today, the Americans lost around 8,000 to 9,000 troops in combat. That same period of time, they have lost 140,000 veterans to suicide.
That's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah. That gets me every time.
Today I have the incredible honour of introducing not just our guest, but my brother, Lance Corporal James Hill, a man whose career defines courage, resilience and absolute commitment to service. After 14 years in the Royal Marines and the elite Special Boat Service, James has epitomised the highest standards of the United Kingdom Special Forces. From the treacherous waters of the Gulf to the battlefields of Helmand Province at the height of the conflict in Afghanistan, he's led teams through some of the most demanding and dangerous operations imaginable. Even after surviving 5 gunshot wounds during a daring raid, his determination and leadership never wavered. Returning to duty in record time, he's a true modern warrior, a quiet professional, and a man whose story reminds us what service, sacrifice, and strength really means. James, my little brother, tell me about your childhood.
Active. Yeah. The good thing is you pretty much know quite a lot about my childhood.
I do, yeah.
But yeah, I have to say, very busy household, having 3 older brothers with lots of friends, living up near the chocolate factory in Bourneville was quite unique. And I think it was probably the best time in terms of my own childhood.
Yeah.
Them years in Maryvale Road.
Yeah.
Really like that before we kind of hit the road and then started bouncing from pub to pub.
Yeah.
But yeah, always looking for adventure and just being with the older kids actually, which in hindsight was probably really good for me further on down the line.
Yeah.
You know, being, I'm not going to say bullied by the older kids. But yeah, just hanging around with the older kids actually gave me a lot more confidence and actually give me that robustness, I guess, you know, within sports and just hanging around.
We should probably explain that comment, pub to pub. Like, we weren't drinking as kids. Yeah, Mom and Dad ran pubs. But you're right, we moved so much.
Yeah.
There was a lot. There was a lot going on.
It was, and I think I understand why we had to do it in terms of just, you know, providing for the family.
Yeah.
I kind of get that. But it was kind of hard, but that did lead to a bit of, I think, chaos as a youngster.
Yeah.
Different environments in terms of different towns and cities. But I also enjoyed the exposure to new things. And again, I think it's just been exposed to that carnage of the pub world.
Yeah.
Just kind of gives you these inner strengths, I guess, without even knowing it when you're little.
Almost being comfortable with not being comfortable in that uncomfortable environment, but just having to deal with it.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, I mean, we'll probably talk about it later, but being uncomfortable is one of the key foundations that we must continue doing throughout our life.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
I think it's toxic being comfortable.
Yeah.
We can get pretty lazy and I've done it myself and I still do it on occasions.
Yeah.
But my childhood was great. The journey in America last year, there's lots of talk about, you know, what happens between the age of 3 and 7 and how that can kind of mold you as an adult going forward, which I found really interesting. So only recently I've been looking back at my childhood to see how, you know, was it good, was it bad, you know, what traumas were there. And actually every time I look back with a smile and I kind of enjoyed it.
That's so good.
Yeah.
So was it during childhood, during those formative years, and I'm sort of thinking early teens, maybe late teens, that you knew that you wanted to join the military, or was it not even on your radar?
You know what? In all honesty, it wasn't on the radar.
What did you want to do?
Oh, you know what? I still don't know. I'm 42. No. No, I think the fire service was always there. I did struggle at school. Not the best grades, but I found it hard in terms of trying to find what I actually truly wanted to go into.
Yeah.
Sports, football was massive when I was growing up. That's all I ever wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But I found it truly hard to kind of find and get my teeth into something. But the military wasn't there anyway. Paul, our older brother, he kind of spoke about the Navy now and again, so maybe planted a seed.
Yeah.
And I do find it fascinating going through the military when you talk to other guys, backgrounds, and I always say from like council estates to country estates, the variety in guys is just unreal.
Really?
Which is great because it broadens my mind on how I interact with my family or my friends and how different we all are.
Yeah.
So I've really enjoyed that aspect of it. But I don't know. I think it's just the adventure.
So when you finished sixth form, what did you do?
Sixth form, I went into the exhibition game. Concentrated on football.
Yeah.
Kind of been a semi-professional, which was great. Enjoying that. I was working around the NEC in Birmingham, doing the exhibition work and the flooring. And that was it. I think there was a stint at McDonald's at one stage, to pay for a lad's holiday, as you do.
Yeah.
At the age of 17. I don't know if I should be saying that. what else did I do? Bloody hell. Then I was doing that, actually. You guys had the big move to Australia.
I was going to say, you come with me and Bren when we left.
Yeah, I think that was the opportunity at 18, 19 to go to Australia.
Yeah.
I remember packing up that bicycle still, and heading out to Australia.
And you stayed with us there for a year, maybe more.
Yeah, I reckon it was a year. And then I think we popped back and forth on and off with David and Stephen. And I think the hard part then was leaving that family to go to Australia, which was amazing experience. Yeah. Again, that sense of adventure, not knowing. Really bizarre. You go to Australia to kind of experience the country. I ended up playing football for a team and staying in one town all season. So kind of, but I loved it, really enjoyed it. Did struggle for work. That was really hard, actually.
Yeah.
Big sister supported me quite a lot financially.
I remember, though, going into your bedroom in Australia and you had a brochure about the Australian military. And I remember that was it the first time that you really started to think, oh, actually, because you were trying to figure out ways that you could stay longer than the year, I think. And if you became part of the... Have I got this right? The Australian military, that you could have got a visa or...
Yeah, so that's it.
Was it there that the seed was planted or no?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's even at school when you go to the, going to the career office to speak to the lady and you kind of hand over your results and she goes, ooh, okay, Jimmy, this is going to be tricky. she was like fire service. Very physical job. In Australia, I remember looking at universities and I'm like, oh my God. Not very confident in terms of the academic side of things. But it was just too much money. I think it was 37,000. I remember like calling mum saying, hey, have you got 37,000? And she, of course, she's like, no. Mum, that's so unfair. I'm the most handsome brother. No, joking.
I'm your favourite child.
Yeah, that's it. So I really struggled. And then perhaps there was a sense of, military calling then.
How old are you now at this point, roughly?
20. I was playing football for 19.
Yeah.
So I got an award for one of the youngest guys there. Yeah, so 19, 20.
19,
yeah,
20.
That was it.
So what's the first real step then to joining? What do you have to do? You being interviewed? Did you go and speak to anybody? Like, so you've made the decision.
Yeah.
I'm going to find out a bit more about this. What do you do?
Yeah, so coming back from Australia.
Yeah.
Pretty much on my own.
Yeah.
So living in one bed. House.
Yeah.
So that was really surreal. So I just went into a recruitment office in Birmingham City Centre. And again, we have got no family background or military or nothing. So I've just like walked in. And there's kind of like three desks. You got like the RAF, the Royal Navy, then the Army. And I've walked in and actually this good looking guy, I don't mind saying it, big muscles kind of just, I just went kind of straight to him and he says, oh, I'm in the Marines. Told him about my background, physically fit, robust. And he says, can you do 6 pull-ups? So I'm like, yeah, doing pull-ups in the office.
Really?
And then he says, take this, I don't know if it was a numeric test or like an engineering test, a mechanical test. I can't think of the wording, but sat down, done that. And I'm pretty sure he didn't even mark it. He was like, you're in. That's another one for me, number. Yes, we said, look, we do a recruitment, not a recruitment, it's called PRMC. So you go down to Limpston, CTRM, CTCRM, Commando Training Center, Royal Marines.
Okay.
So you do a long weekend down there and you pretty much get a taster of what it's going to be like. So basically it's a long weekend of just physically being put through your paces. And there's about 50 of you that have come together and tried out, and I really enjoyed it. It was wet, it was miserable, and I just enjoyed it. And this
What did you do? What do they get you doing?
Things like the bottom field, like assault courses, gym work, but not in terms of being a gym queen, like physical courses within the gym.
Rope climbs and stuff.
Yeah, rope climbs and just circuits. That's the word I'm looking for.
You do
circuits in the gym.
Yeah.
Then you'd have lectures on medical maybe, or, you know, the history of the Marines and what they do, what you can look forward to if you to join and succeed, the different careers you can go down.
Okay.
And I just seemed to really enjoy the environment. The environment was quite good.
Yeah.
Definitely different to actually the training.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't as nice. So really enjoyed that. So yeah, they just said, look, come back. And it just got delayed and delayed and delayed. So I remember leaving with a brand new pair of leather boots. They were horrendous. And they're like, break these in, you're going to need them. And so I'd be running around King's Heath at the time with a daysack on and these boots looking like a right numpty, trying to break these boots in, trying to keep fit to join Limpston, which was the start
of my
military
career.
Which is
that training course.
Yeah.
And what was the gap then between that taster weekend and then you going down?
I reckon it went on for about 8 months.
Really?
It was a long process. So, I mean, I could have walked at any time, but I think I just had it. I was set on it then.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of gave me purpose without knowing about it.
Yeah.
And I think I really enjoyed that. There was, James had a meaning then, you know, had something to hold on to.
A direction.
Yeah. And I liked it. So, because I think I was pretty much, my anchor was football and I was just going everywhere with it. And I kind of started to come to the realization that I need to kind of start growing up.
Yeah.
<You know?
laughs>
the kind of military was the way.
Yeah. So we go down. Talk to me about that training.
Yeah, so
it's 40 weeks, right?
I think it's now 38.
Okay.
But when we did it, it was 33 weeks training.
Oh, 33, okay.
Yeah. And there's a really famous kind of part where you all have to go into Exmoor and get the train into Limpston.
Okay.
And there's photos where guys are all in suits. So they're all looking good in their suits. They've got a suitcase.
And then
half of them have got an ironing board under their arm. And I'm just... So you get off this train, it's only one stop, and you get up. So civilians are on the train as well, but then they're carrying on somewhere else. But all these Royal Marines get off onto this military platform.
Wow.
And you're just out looking at the estuary, the river.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great, the scenery is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then that's it. Your training team come out and just, you know, start to, that's it. It starts there.
And did you stay there for the entire 33 weeks, or were you able to come home during that?
Yeah, so everything's incremental, and this is why I think it's just amazing. So, I mean, one of the final tests is like a 30-mile speed march, but on day one, you know, you'll probably run 5 kilometres, and then it's incremental.
Okay.
But it's the same with stress levels. You know, they build you up to the chaos and carnage.
Okay.
And it's the same on day one, so... Within the first 16 weeks, I don't think you have to be back on camp by 10 o'clock. And I think the first 9 weeks, if I can remember, you're not allowed to leave the camp. So you have to kind of stay there.
Yeah.
And I get that because you've got all these different personalities and guys coming in. And it's just the same for every single person. So a bit like G.I. Jane, you go in, you get your head shaved, which isn't a problem anymore. You know, I think there might be compensation there or something. I'm going to blame them. No. So you get your head shaved and then you just... Foundation is just 2 weeks of being absolutely hammered. How to wash, how to clean your clothes, how
Seriously?
To iron, and then the PT that's involved, constantly moving, constantly getting your, and they're just building you up to kind of get your body robust for the tests that lie ahead.
Body and your mind a little bit too.
100%.
Yeah.
And to be honest, going into it pretty blind, I think I prefer going in blind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some people say it's winging it, which I'm learning to be really good at, actually.
Yeah.
No, but I like kind of going into blinds. I think, I'm better that way because I don't actually stress about these things. I don't think about them. I just, if someone asks me to do something, I'll go and do it and that's it. And I think it kind of worked that way. So I think it's an advantage not knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
And you just get on with it. I was 23 when I joined.
Yeah.
Dad, unfortunately, just passed away beforehand.
Yeah.
I was just gone then. I was like, let's do this. Yeah.
What was it? Tell me about the training, because you said they build you up and build you up and build you up.
Yeah.
So by the time you get to, let's just pick a week 30, how different is it from week one?
So you're being introduced to a world that is, it is frantic. You're learning a new language. So the lingo is just completely different.
Yeah.
So everything is acronyms.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you've got to pick up this new language within the military. And it is really bizarre, because when you come home, you start saying these words and the family are like, what are you on about? You sound like you're in the military now.
Yeah.
But in terms of, luckily I was physically fit going into it, but I don't think I was military fit.
And okay.
It's a cross between, I don't know, like having that robustness of a rugby player,
yeah.
You know, that brute strength and having that impact with the weight that you have to carry over long distances in all kinds of terrain and weather. But then also learning what the Royal Marines stand for and the history behind it all. So I think you really do start learning the key principles of leadership, courage, bravery,
humility.
So, and I think it's you're just evolving as an individual, but then as a unit as well. And I think that's where a lot of individuals do struggle in the transition, we'll probably talk about later, is they lose that identity.
And the chaos, you mentioned there that they're also building you to deal with the chaos. What does that look like in training?
So there's always objectives to pass within training. So I remember the first time you bivvy out, so basically just sleeping under a tent.
Yeah.
It's like being at scouts. It's on the bottom field, which is, say, like a football pitch.
Yeah.
You get your bivvy and your weapons and the helmets are all like wonky. The weapons are left everywhere. And I think you're running around with a stick at first, you know, because you're not trusted, you know, as a civilian from the couch, you know. So, and basically it's just getting you structured into how to do things.
Yeah.
And why I talk about that first night when you sleep under the stars, you know, with your bag and then someone's on sentry. You know, and then someone comes and wakes you and says, your turn to go watch nothing. You know, go look that way for an hour and then someone's going to change. You know, it's just the structure, and that's what they're amazing at doing. They build you up into this machine. So the rotation's great, I feel, but a lot of it's down to mindset, and a lot of guys do struggle. So I can't remember in the Marines, I think we started with around 60 guys. And then I did pass out as an original. So the 923 troop was my troop, and I passed out as an original. So I luckily continued throughout the 33 weeks without being injured, booted off, or back trooped, which is great.
Yeah.
Luckily, I did have an incident with my wrist.
I was just going to say,
which wasn't
good.
Do
you mind if I bring that up?
Because I don't think many people know about it.
I don't. Yeah. Well, and we can cut it out if you don't want to put it in.
No, it's just
but
funny.
I remember you came home and you injured your wrist. And didn't you have to have a cast or something on it? And we were like, well, that's it, you're out. Because secretly, we all wanted you to leave. Because actually, this is getting pretty serious now. And you were like, absolutely not. And you took it off and you went back.
Yeah, it was stupid. So I think that was week 30, Christmas.
You were so close. It was
honestly,
Christmas, that's
right.
Yeah.
And then we all went out on the pop.
Yeah.
And I think we had to be back by 12, and we were with the training team, because at this stage now everyone's kind of passed.
Yeah.
There's a 10-day final ex that you have to do, which means going into the field, doing ambushes, certain scenarios, you know, troop harbours in the forest.
Yeah.
Again, staring at nothing, and there was enemy, you know, that kind of stuff. And that was the kind of last exercise before you go into King's squad, which is 2 weeks of drill. You know,
okay.
You know, dressed up in your number ones and you do all the drill.
Yeah.
So that evening I woke up on shit, said to the boss, look, basically what happened, we were running, and as I've jumped over this chain, one of the guys lifted it.
So
I've tripped and I've landed on my wrist. And as a result, the next morning I woke up and I'm like, that does not feel good. So I said, look, I can't do morning PT. Do you mind me sitting out? He's like, absolutely fine. The next day, then we all break up for 2 weeks leave. So I think David picked me up and I said, David, look, I'm going to have to get a scan on this because it's not right.
Yeah.
It's massive.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've come out of hospital with a cast. So I'm just like, this ain't going to heal in 2 weeks. So, I didn't tell anyone. Wasn't too sure what to do. And again, back on the train, heading down to Limpston. And I've got this cast on with a coat over it. Because as we go down the stops, we're picking up guys and we're meeting them again. I'm like, oh my God, I've got this cast on. I'm like, what do I do? And there was two guys I spoke to, Ben and Pete. Pete's left, Ben's still in. And I met him in there and I went into the toilet and I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I just cut it off. So I cut it off and I thought, right. And I said to the guys, look, I might need help here for this 10-day exercise. And so I just managed to kind of get through it. I just didn't want to get back through.
I was going to say, would you have to go all the way to the beginning again?
No, you kind of have to wait. It's every 2 weeks there's a new troop kind of coming through. So you'd have to sit in a hunter troop.
Yeah.
So if you get injured, you go into hunter troop. And there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You just sit there and you wait for the next troop and then you jump on board and then you go across. But I was like, you've built up such a bond with these guys.
Yeah,
I just want to stick with it.
Yeah.
It was probably stupid. But I did it. I got through, did drill, and that was it. I just had to get through that 10-day exercise, which I did.
Yeah.
And then it was really funny because when you've got to make an impression when you go to your first unit, which is up in Scotland.
Yeah.
So again, we're doing the circuit. There's a theme about circuits and stuff. And the circuit involved a boxing bag. And I'm like, my wrist still not right. So I'm there going, jab, jab, boop, jab, jab, boop. And I'm like, is I hit that? Bloody bag, really? I'm like, oh my God. I'm like,
oh no.
Yeah, so I had to kind of come clean with the offer to say, look, you know, I've damaged my wrist.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But it was fine after that. Luckily, it's all healed up.
All healed.
Had a good career.
I want to talk to you. You mentioned a couple of times there about the brotherhood. How different is it? Because obviously you've got three brothers.
Yeah.
How different is the bond between your siblings but your brotherhood in the military?
Very different.
Explain to me how.
It's for me, it's different in terms of some of the guys really expose themselves mentally.
Not literally.
Yeah, well, no, both actually. So I've seen many things that people don't want to see. They do expose themselves in terms of they open up on, you know, when you're physically and emotionally drained, you do become more vulnerable. And some guys on an evening where they're just like, they've had enough, they want to quit and you kind of talk them out of it or vice versa, you know, they do open up a bit more.
Yeah.
But, you know, you live with these guys for so long and some of the backgrounds are so interesting. You just kind of, you do become brothers, you know, within that short amount of time because you're indoctrinated into this unit.
Yeah.
You're all supporting each other from day one. So you can pretty much, you can talk to anyone about anything. And within the brotherhood, you got smaller, like little circles as and you have little cliques.
Because you were really close to Pete.
Yeah, Pete and Ben were great. And we had like a room, each room had six people in and like you become a little unit yourself. So, but you could pretty much talk to anyone about anything and not be embarrassed about it or, or anything like that. You know, you'd get a 9 times out of 10, you'd get a sensible comment back, you know, sometimes they'd give you a bit of a dig or take the mick, you know, but it's part and parcel of it.
Yeah.
But it is completely different. Whereas my brothers, you know, I can be open, I suppose, but there's some things when I'd come back off leave, you know, I wouldn't say, or I'd keep a secret.
Yeah,
I'd hold back a little bit.
Yeah.
I wouldn't tell too much of the story. Cause I'm like, they would be pretty shocked, you know, with some of the stories. So you kind of learn to kind of keep things in a little bit or hide a few things.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
Yeah.
And by the end of the 33 weeks, because you also mentioned mindset, what changed in your mindset from week one to the end of the training? What stands out to you as being the biggest shift in your mindset there?
Yeah, that for me, I would say because I think resilience is this buzzword at the minute. And it's not that, because I don't think you know that until you've kind of you've analysed it or you've looked back and you've kind of assessed the situations that you've been through to kind of realise that's what you go through. For me, I think it's knowing I was learning my own limits physically and mentally, what I could and couldn't do. Mm. It's really interesting how people talk about selection, joining the kind of UKSF in terms of that was one of the hardest courses I will ever do, but not once did I say I was going to quit or voluntary withdrawal, they call it. It didn't come into my mind at all. But I had a moment in Royal Marines training where I was like, I can't do this. You know, I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Wow.
I'm getting 400 quid a month, I think it was.
Yeah.
At 23 now.
Yeah.
You know, going from a good job in the exhibition game.
Yeah.
I'm like, what am I doing this for? I think it was on exercise, so I was run down mentally. The weather was as usual. We were all soaked through, and I'm just like, really? Are the family? Am I going to put them? And then I'm like finding things to kind of support my theory, and I'm reasoning with myself, and I'm just like, you know, I could think of 99 reasons to leave, and then I'm fighting against one reason to stay, and I'm just like, it just outweighed it crazy. So I actually went and spoke to the officer that night. I said,
I said, look,
I'm having a wobble here. I said, I don't know why, but I said, I don't know if this is for me. I'm just like, this is, and you are going from couch to Marine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that I do feel that is a massive transition, especially if you've got no family history in military.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just like, bloody hell, this is, so I'm trying to get all my eggs in one basket in my head. And then literally says, look, I tell you what, if you still feel like this in the morning, come back to me after the exercise is over.
Okay.
So again, just like, you know, I go back, you know, you're getting your dry clothes, you know, miserable, you know, and then you wake up in the morning and then you're off again. You're constantly moving. You're constantly doing something. And then I never thought about it ever again. And the officer never brought it up once. So in terms of leadership on his behalf, whether he meant to or not, I think for that reason, he could have said, right, Jimmy, just get in the wagon and leave then, you know, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether that's good tactics on his behalf in terms of that leadership to say, you know what, just sleep this off. I've had this before with guys coming from Civilian Street. Just it's just you're having an episode. Yeah. You know, man up and just get with it. You know. I'm glad he did.
That's crazy to think that. And we will come on to the SF training in a minute. But the fact that you had a wobble there in your first training but didn't in SF, that in itself, I think, shows how much your mindset had then changed.
Yeah, I think so.
So you finish, you qualify, you get your Green Beret. How does that feel?
Yes.
I remember that day. We all went down.
Yeah, you kind of, you get your Green Beret, which is great.
Yeah.
You get accepted into this. I mean, when you're in it, you are like in this elite group, you know, and it is a boys, it's a boys club. Mm. And the reason I say boys is because the Marines at the time, it's just men, you know. And I you get a sense of, you know, you are proud for that split second, but then they're like, right, we're going to be all smiles because your family are here. You know, it's like, you know, do not tell them the truth. No, joking. So they turn around and says, look, you know, this, be proud. Family are proud. You know, tomorrow the real work starts. You know, oh my God, I've just done all that. And when you're telling me now I've got to start from scratch again.
Yeah.
But again, it's the mindset. So now you're peak in the Royal Marines.
Yeah.
And then you move to another unit. And then you're proving yourself to all the older and bolder guys trying to get accepted into that brotherhood again, because you all get split up then.
Deliberately?
You all bombursed all over the country. Some went straight out to Afghanistan. Some went to Scotland. They went all over the country.
So you can't say, please, can I stay with Pete?
Yeah. So I was classed as a diamond. So
what's that mean?
There is, you can be a King's Badgeman. So if you're a King's Badgeman, and I think we had two in the end, they get to choose where they want to go in terms of a bit of reward.
Yeah.
And then a diamond, the six diamonds within the group.
Nice.
And you also get to kind of decide where you want to go. So,
okay.
So they said, Jimmy, where do you want to go? I had a choice to go out to Afghan straight away. But I didn't feel ready, I suppose, even though we have trained, we've been assessed and we are good to go. We can do that job. And guys done it. They proved themselves and they did amazing. But I decided to go up to Scotland to do the maritime security up there and loved it. And that's when I ended up heading out to the Gulf on counter-piracy tour, which was great again. And I love that.
Talk to me about that.
And we stayed with Pete.
Because this is your first job now, isn't it? You know, you're qualified. Yeah. This is your first, what do you call it? Assignment.
Kind of, yeah, first tour.
First tour.
Yeah.
First
tour. So yeah, Faslane or Camach was my first unit to be part of, which was great.
Yeah.
So you integrate then with a load of other Marines that have kind of done all kinds, and you can imagine old and bold, different ranks. The first time you see your commanding officer who's now in control of you, you know, I was 23 thinking, you know, it's I think that helped being a bit older.
Yeah.
Understanding the whole, I wouldn't say that the psychology of the game, you know, there's only so much they can push you.
Yeah.
You know, physically they can't, you know, there was no bullying. There was nothing like that. You know, you hear some crazy stories. They have to push you and you have to accept that it's going to be tough. They have to talk down to you. They've got to see if you've got what it takes, because ultimately you're going to fight next to, I could be fighting next to the guy who took me through training.
Yeah,
so he has
to
pass us out. He has to say, I would stand next to this guy on the battlefield. So I get, you know, how challenging it has to be. You know, people see it differently. But being older, I thought, help me, because I could, like, understand some of the BS that goes on. But that's a rite of passage. So when I got there, I sat in there, sat in front of this officer, you know, he's a big strapping guy. And I'm like, yeah, so I'm 23. So, you know, I reckon I'm quite mature. And he's like, age means fuck all. You know, and I'm like, okay. He goes, I'm 21. I'm like, oh, fuck, you know, well, no, that's a great start. What we're trying to get at is like, look, you know, I'm a responsible guy. I can do this, you know, like.
Have faith in me.
Yeah, have faith. And it was brilliant. He was pulling my chain. And it was amazing actually just to start learning after the older guys.
Yeah.
But what I didn't realize was some of the old guys that were in, they had amazing experience, but coming from Limston, you had the latest kit, the latest technique and tactics. Yeah. And actually they sometimes leaned on you in terms of saying, oh, is this how they do it down there? And and that was really nice to kind of speed up that acceptance in terms of, I am one of you guys. And there are initiations that you might have to pass, which we definitely won't talk about.
Really?
No chance. Yeah, there was exposure. but again, that's all part of the kind of
the
brotherhood.
Bonding,
it breaks down them barriers we were talking about earlier, like with my brothers. You know, if I did the same with my brothers,
they'd be shocked.
Yeah, they'd be completely shocked, you know. But we have to break barriers down quicker because of the pace of life within the military.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So the first tour, you scared?
Nervous, quite excited. And was I lucky to go on it? Basically, someone had gone out the night before down in a famous town called Helensburgh, Scotland, and got in a bit of trouble. So I woke up and every morning, just like, you know, like taking the register, sounds very schooly, but you'd go down 8 o'clock and say, right, are you all here? Any issues? Right, go to the gym, sort yourself out, come back. And then we start the day kind of 10 o'clock with lectures or mission briefs or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And one of these guys unfortunately got caught up in a situation where he got pulled from a 6-man team. So they were like, right, who wants to go to golf? I'm like, yeah, I'll go. You know, just like, let's do this. And he goes, right, pack your bags, you're going tomorrow. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, that quick, you know? So that was quite exciting. I was looking forward to it. I knew the guys I was going with.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of that small knit community.
Yeah.
So to operate on a Navy ship that holds over 1,000 individuals, men and women.
Wow.
To be a small unit with on that ship was great. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't get involved with the Navy NIFNAF and trivia.
Okay.
Which I would struggle with if I hadn't gone down the Navy routes.
Yeah.
Which I can talk about, you know, easily.
What is that NIFNAF you talk about?
Yeah,
what
not NIFNAF. So as a youngster going through the Navy, from my eyes and what I saw being on ship for them 6 months, 3 months, and them tours that I did over a year, was the hardships that they have to go through on ship as a young, passed out recruit. Well, they're not a recruit. They've earned their stripes, but there's certain things they have to do. And I'm like, bloody hell, you know. And I get it. It's a rite of passage. And then when you earn your stripes and you become a sergeant, a corporal within the Navy, and, you know, you then have that respect and you pass that on to the guys that are coming through.
Yeah.
And it is a rite of passage, but I'm like, I would have struggled, you know, having to parade every day on ship Captain Rounds, polish the ship twice a day. It really, really, really hard kind of environment to operate for me, being kind of, I won't say I'm a free spirit, but I just like the idea of being able to kind of bounce around.
Yeah.
So that kind of small man team, it really worked well for me.
So the first tour was what, 3 months? 6 months?
It was about 4 months.
About 4 months.
Out at sea, out in the Gulf, doing the counter-piracy, which was great. So that was protecting ships and vessels and drug smugglers within that Gulf region. And I really enjoyed it because I got to see a broader picture of how the military operate, which is great. So we're mixing with the officers on ship and just trying to understand. I'm playing catch up, having no experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So now I know the history of the Royal Marines. And now I'm trying to look at the wider scope of how these things work to understand it myself. But I really enjoyed that. So anytime we got called to action, the boat would get dropped into the water, we'd jump on it, and then we'd go chasing these little dhows, which had Somalians on boats. They may be armed, they may not be armed, they may just be fishermen or captains that are just porting rice from border to border, but you know, intelligence would tell us this boat, that boat, yeah. and we'd go off and do it. And
yeah.
I kind of really, I enjoyed that.
Did you? Yeah.
It was just something different. We had a routine again. Routine's key.
Yeah.
And that discipline. I just love the discipline of it all.
Yeah.
You just, there's even, I know I use the word chaos and it sounds mental, but within that chaos, you have that discipline that controls everything.
Mm.
And I think when you're in that routine and structure, it makes things so much more easier.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can concentrate on what I'm actually supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And that's what I think I really enjoyed.
Did you feel ready? Like, you're so quickly on a tour after training, but did you feel that the training equipped you, or was there any point you thought,
honestly,
I don't know what I'm doing?
The training and the structure was amazing. So for me, it wasn't, they give me all the tools to go out and assign me to anything, you know, within that remit of the Royal Marines. For me, it was just confidence in my own ability that they've given me.
Yeah.
So they've given me the tools. I just have to showcase it now and say, look, I know this. Now I just need to deliver it and just become comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So the training elements in any organization is when you have chronic or acute stress, you know, they're massive, them two things. And one can be very erosive. Chronic stress can just eat away at your health physically and mentally. Mm. When we're talking about acute stress, you look at things like athletes and sportsmen waiting for that gun to go off for the 100 meters. That acute stress is what makes them winners. Because they're like, they're hyper-vigilant now. They're like ready. And I think that's what we get used to through training.
Yeah.
You know, it is, you are a bull in a china shop when it starts. You're just like, you're running around like a headless chicken because you're like, what is this?
Kicking
this
the doors.
Mental. Yeah. And then after a while, you become numb to it. And there is a part of it where, you know, empathy can kind of play a part in it. And I know some of the family have kind of turned around and said, bloody hell, you kind of, you're a bit non-emotional at times when you should be emotional. And I'm trying to be more aware of that for other people's feelings and that as I leave. But that's more about the transition
and being
aware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about now the decision and how that came about to go SBS. How did that? How long are you a Marine doing tours before you think, you know what, let's take this up a notch?
Yeah, you know what's really...
Let's really terrify Mom.
What's really interesting with that is there is a mysteriousness. So you know these guys exist and you know there's a world out there that you know nothing about.
Yeah.
They're in the shadows for a reason and I completely get that and it should stay that way. So the first experience was out in Afghanistan and a helicopter flies in, these cool... They all have hair, which is a fucking annoying, you know, they're all like, you know, looking good. Now they've got all the latest kit, all the latest weapons and just their persona and the way they kind of presented themselves. I'm like, who are these guys? And I said, oh, you know what, these are UK Special Forces. And I'm like, okay, you know, what are they up to? Oh, can't tell you. I'm like, oh, that's annoying. You know, I want to learn more. And then you might see them walking around like training centres that you're operating on and they just have a different way of... They have a different gait. I don't know if it's because we're looking at them like, it sounds really weird, but superheroes or fanboys. Like,
he's
one of them. You know, like, it's so bizarre.
What do they do?
Is that schoolboy stuff? So kind of you're aware it exists. And then when I was out in Afghan and we did a whole tour, we had a pretty hard tour like everyone does out in Afghan and it's very kinetic, rounds, firing, IEDs, explosions. There's all these things that are going on. And again, it was like being back at training. I'm starting to weigh up my future. I'm like, what do I do? Where do I go? Do I believe in the system and what we're doing? Absolutely. So I'm like, right, how can I make this more meaningful? And yes, we can always say, I want to challenge. I really want to push myself. But I think it was more to do. I wanted a more direct approach to making a difference.
Yeah.
And I think everyone in the military wants to make a difference. I honestly believe no one joins to harm life at all.
Yeah.
I think people join maybe knowing that.
That it's going to be a part of
it. It's going to be a part of it.
But that's not the motivation.
And honestly, in any industry, I don't care what industry, you're always going to get a bad egg. You know, even within selection, you're always going to, I mean, I could have been a bad egg. I don't know what people talk about behind my back. But you're always going to have that bad egg who, you know, they might be a bit egotistic and they might be, you know, I'm the bit, you know, the dog's ball sort of thing. Yeah. So, but yeah, I just wanted to then, I just wanted to step it up a bit more. And then knowing a bit more, talking to the guys out in Afghan, I thought, you know what, let's call up, let's make the call, made the call, right, you're on another breathing course. I'm like, oh my God, this is it. So then I started training out in the desert again, boots on, weight on. I'm physically fit anyway, because the stuff you've got to carry out in Afghan on the patrols anyway, you're kind of ready for it. So it was a really good time. Again, my body was ready for it. So me, it was again, learning new equipment and kit and that kind of side of things.
That Afghan tour, was that the last tour as a Marine?
That was the last tour I did as a Marine, yeah.
Wow, how tough was that?
That was hard. So we were a troop that bounced around quite a lot. So we started off at Kajaki Dam, which was great. And we were just holding Kajaki. We took over it from the paras, I believe. That was really hard in terms of watching the activity in the what they call the green zone. And Afghan is a beautiful country. And I learned a lot more when I was there in terms of, you know, it used to be a tourist destination, which was crazy in the 60s, I believe.
No way. Didn't know that.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, hippies and that kind of stuff was going on down there, you know, and psychedelics.
Okay.
And bloody hell. So, and you can see the attraction because of how nice it is. So this green zone is just so nice. So anytime within Afghan, you have like a massive river flowing through either side, maybe 2 kilometres, you've just got flush green forestry because they dig these trenches in that kind of water irrigation systems.
Okay.
And it's unbelievable. Then you just literally do 180 and then you've just got desert and mountains. I'm like, this is so weird. So we'd be at the high point, just taking all this in, doing overwatch on this village, making sure that what we were protecting and looking after, basically we were trying to watch for individuals laying explosives on certain parts, strategical parts of roadways, making sure that it didn't get blocked off, so to speak. And we were there for Hearts and Minds as well, which was a hard one because of...
What does that mean, Hearts and
Minds? Hearts and Minds, we were there trying to make peace.
Oh, I see.
With the locals. But they've got it really hard because they're trying to please us, but also please the Taliban and their locals.
Yeah.
And it's catch 22 for them guys, so I felt for them. So we lost over 20 guys. I think the number was actually 23 guys that on that tour, which is hard. And even to this day, some guys are still affected by maybe what they've seen or the trauma or the pressures that's kind of have led from that tour. Not led from that tour, but
I know
as a consequence
mean.
From that
yeah,
tour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I felt I wasn't doing enough, if I'm honest.
Okay,
and being a Valan man was probably one of the... Did I find it stressful? So a Valan man is, you see the guys on the beach with a metal detector.
Yeah.
So that was my role. And I always remember going...
So you went out first.
Yeah, so check. I was literally guiding the troop behind me, giving them safe passage to wherever or whatever compound we had to go to or whatever patrol routine we had to do. And basically I was looking for explosives, which is mental, because if I was to miss one and then 3 or 4 guys down accidentally stood on an IED... I can't imagine how I would feel. I mean, it never happened. Thank God, touch wood. You know, we were always safe. I mean, that alone must...
It's a massive...
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Responsibility.
It is hard. And I mean, when you're operating in a corridor of talcum powder, believe it or not, it is insane. So then the bizarre part is when you come under contact, which we did, you had to stay in that lane, which is really weird.
Shit.
And visually... jesting, the hard part is you'd come into contact and you'd have to pepper pot back out. But if I've done a route that looks like snakes and ladders, you've then got these fucking guys peeling back doing snakes and ladders because they've got to follow the same route back because they know it's the safest route. And I'm like, oh my God, you kind of, at times you did feel like sitting ducks.
Yeah.
So sometimes we would just sit and suppress. And then that way, if we just sat and suppress and waited, calling fire, it was a bit more safer than actually trying to
go
retreat.
Back.
But honestly, with no plan survives the first contact. There's a saying within, you know, plan A never works. You know, you're constantly thinking on your feet all the time. And just that adaptability that we always talk about, you have to adapt in moments of chaos. And that's what it was like always. So that was really interesting. But that the Valan man stuff. And I actually never mentioned it. Just I kind of... Yeah, I don't think about it, but actually looking back at that, and when I look back, I always remember halfway through the tour, I'm like, look, can I not be the GPMG gunner and carry the big sexy gun?
You know,
just run around with that for a bit. And the sergeant major just said, Jimmy, look, you know, I trust you. You've got a good head on your shoulders. Just keep kind of doing what you're doing. I'm like, oh, this is really, really frustrating. It's not that I didn't want to do it. I wanted to do something different within the tour, but I understand it now. It's a bit like having a great goalkeeper. You know, if you've got a great goalkeeper, the defenders are going to be more confident to perform. And I think maybe that's what it was. I don't know. So that was interesting.
So it was at that point then that you started to think, right, I want to do more. This isn't ticking all the boxes.
Yeah.
Made the call for Special Forces. That sounds like it happens real fast.
It does. So again, there's a whole process like joining the Marines. So again, I had to do another course and they kind of work on something really simple in terms of just assessing your fitness and capability to get in that. It's a voluntary system where, you know, you have to put your name forward.
Okay.
I believe in America, they do it differently. They actually, you get invited in.
Mm.
I don't know. I think, you know, they're very similar in terms of the structure of the how the systems work.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately they create amazing operators.
So
we had to do the week course. So I got my, you know, I got my tick again to say, yep, you can now progress to the kind of, again, another 6 months of training.
6 months.
Yeah. So the hard part there was I think I made the decision, whereas if I didn't pass, then I would leave the military.
Okay.
I kind of had that mindset. So ultimately I kind of, my director, Scott, always says about, it's a leap of faith. You have to take a leap of faith at times. And so I got taken off a course that I was going to go on in the Marines as my kind of safe haven backup.
Yeah.
He says, no, I'm just going to take you off that. I'm like, okay, so I've got to pass this course. So I went through and I did get through this course. I always say luckily, and I don't mean to take away any seriousness from the course, but I call it, or you hear a lot of it in our community, imposter syndrome. So on day one, you've got like 100 to 200 guys from all over the UK military, from different backgrounds, different units, whether it's RAF, Marines, Army, all in one room. So you can imagine the testosterone in that. You can imagine that room. Everyone's like looking around and you just, there might be people that have took you on training courses. I'm like, oh my God, he took me through training.
Yeah.
He's here with me. Instant bond. And you think, okay, good guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's just the first 3 weeks are just brutal. They're just like, right, we need to whittle this down. We can't take everyone on this course.
Really?
We can't feasibly take this many people through the course. So we need, how do we test these guys physically and mentally? And they've built it over time. So certain training methods to kind of succeed and get the best out of individuals. And it's not about breaking the individual down so there's nothing left in them at all. They're just seeing where their pressure points are. So physically, you know, it's well known, you know, we train now in Wales or Scotland, you know, because that terrain is just brutal. And the weather, out there is just nuts. You don't know what you're going to get.
So 6 months training, does that mean you are now off tour, off active duty, and you are back to pure training all over again?
Yes. So it's another selection. Ultimately, it's another military course that you have to get verification that you're able to achieve certain markers and goals to kind of get through to move on yet to another unit. So very, very mysterious in terms of no one knows what goes on within these courses as such. I mean, there's bits and bobs around the internet that you can find out. I think they publish stuff themselves in terms of the structure of the courses. But you never truly know, because you always get guys that have been pulled off the course or they've failed and then they just slag it all off saying, oh, the training team didn't like me and they had a grudge against me. I'm like, look, you got to hold yourself accountable. Is it the case? And I don't think the guys are in it for that reason. They're there to pass the guys out. They're going to be fighting alongside these guys.
Yeah.
So... yeah, another 6 months.
And mentally and physically, is it harder than your first course?
It is harder.
Is it?
100%. But this time I've got the experience of going through so many courses.
And tours.
And tours. And I think being used to that fast pace of life, again, I don't know what other word to use other than chaos. When you're so used to that noise and you can almost slow time down, you can kind of assess things a lot better. Yes, going into the world with a load of guys that you don't know and a structure that you're not too sure on which direction it's going to go on. is difficult in itself, but it's very much, for me, it was more of a mind game, staying injury free, looking after myself, and kind of, again, doing the foundation really, doing the basics right. If you do the basics right, you've got a really good chance of doing something. Guys do mess up. Guys do have accidents, which will result in a pulling off course. And then you only get two tries. Then you have to wait then another 6 months or so before you get another shot at it, really.
So you went right through to the finish line.
Yeah, kind of right through. Again, I mean, we had great guys, and some guys got injured, you know, running around the mountains. They'd get DNV. Vomiting. And their body, you're so saturated anyway.
Yeah.
They would try and crack on, but they're just so depleted. They can't get the food in, and their body just can't do it. And the distances you're covering over that certain terrain and elevation is just insane. You could be doing a back-to-back marches of 24 kilometers over that terrain in snow, rain, sunshine. And all them elements, sunshine, it sounds great, but if you're overheating on these runs, it's hard to cool down. So a lot of guys actually prefer the rain and cold weather because it's easier to heat up and kind of look after the body that way. So I think the ultimate test then is the last test, which is like a 60-kilometer kind of assessment over 20 hours with all the kit on and navigation. And so
this is that yomp you used to tell us about.
Yeah, it's the yomping, and I think it's underestimated how kind of hard physically demanding it is and how much you get in your own head.
Really?
So no one talks to you, no one tells you how well you're getting on, and no one tells you how bad you're getting on. So when you don't get feedback, that plays on your mind, because you could have a misdemeanor and that monster grows in your head. You're thinking, oh my God, they're thinking that, you know, I didn't give the right answer. That just evolves into this massive scenario in your head that you play over and over again, and you've got 5 hour walk to think about it. You know, so you think, oh well, I might as well just quit. You know, I know one of the guys, there was only a handful of us that passed this march. Again, it was 24 kilometers, 30 kilometers, something like that. Torrential rain, you know, it was the worst ever. No, it wasn't. It was a bad day. They actually extended the cutoff time by like 30 minutes, which is, it's kind of unheard of, just because of
the weather was so bad.
Yeah, but only a handful of us made that cutoff time, the original time. So then there was a guy, he just kind of halfway through doing his assessments, you know, his distance, time, speed. He was like, I'm not going to do this. So when he got to a checkpoint, he says, look, I'm not going to make it. And they were like, well, are you going to VW? They can't take, you know. He says, yeah, I voluntarily withdraw. Then he got back to us and we're all kind of laughing and giggling as you do. You know, we made it another day. You kind of forget that day and you prep for the next day. And he's like, oh my God, they've extended the time. How stupid am I? Yeah, and then he had to start again.
No.
Yeah, so that was him done. And I'm like, fuck it, you just got to keep going. And I think taking that mentality in terms of until they either pull you off or you're injured or something along them lines, then, you know, they are there to get you through the course. You know, there's so many different stories you hear, you know, some bad, bad rumors. You know, it's designed to be tough and challenge you.
Yeah.
It has to be. You know, you're looking after the country, as cheesy as that sounds, and you want the best people to do that.
Yeah.
So, so with some amazing individuals.
What's one thing about that course, final question about all the training, but what's one thing that you think civilians just wouldn't understand? Because bearing in mind, you're doing this course having done the Marines course first, so you are prepped. What's one thing that civilians just wouldn't get?
Yeah, so I suppose I can talk about it, because actually the guys, the RAF train guys up to do something called SEER, and escape and evasion, and that's pretty brutal, where you go on the run for 5 days. You go on the run, you get hunted, and then ultimately you will get caught, and then you have to go through a scenario of kind of going again through different tests and stages to kind of pass that.
That white noise they talk about?
Yeah, there's loads of different scenarios.
The baby's crying and stuff.
I don't want to say too much. But
okay.
Yeah, that's pretty hard. But I think ultimately for me, it's actually understanding the dangers of training in real life scenarios. So you think ultimately what these guys have to train for, and it's battle, whether that's close quarter combat. So taking, you know, it sounds cheesy and I hate saying it, but if you were to take this room down, it's kind of mano, you know, it's however you say it, you know, there could be someone in this room. So you have to train for that day in, day out. So a lot of people forget that, yes, we may not be fighting a war at the minute in Afghan because we've all pulled out, but these guys are still training in live scenarios with live ammunition on a day-to-day basis. So to do that is so impressive, and to be so on point, 100%, you've got to perform at 100%, you know, here in the UK, training. And I think people forget that when it's not in the media.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that we don't forget that, that these guys are on standby to
all the time,
jump on it and be 100%. I kind of enjoy knowing that I've got a small insight into what we used to do.
Yeah.
It kind of gives me comfort for my family.
So you pass out, it's all done. Mm. What then?
Yeah.
How old are you now, by the way, actually? Yeah. Let's just...
20... So I did about 4 years, I think, four years in the Marines, and then 10 in the service. But yeah, I think I was around 27.
Okay.
About 27, 28. So you had to have a couple of tours before you can kind of do that to have some sort of experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I, and the great thing is you stay at one unit that's located in the UK and you just stay there. So there's no moving around within the Royal Marines. You kind of every 2 years, you bounce around.
Somewhere else.
Which is fine. And it's great as a youngster, maybe a single guy.
Yeah.
If you are a family man, I understand the pressures then of family life and the dynamics can be quite hard. But staying in that one location was amazing because that was it. You could set roots up and you know, it just gives the family maybe a bit more clarity.
And where were you based?
Down south the UK. Yeah. So we... for us and family-wise, I think I was still, I think I had met Irene in the Marines. Oh, just before I went on tour, actually. Yeah, before I went on tour. So she kind of understood me being away and she's quite independent anyways, you know?
Yeah.
So, having that base, actually, it's kind of, it did help not having to move around the country.
So, got to talk about the incident.
Oh, yeah.
How many tours had you done before we get to the fatal one?
So in all three, tours around the country.
Yeah.
Then there's certain tours that you're on standby on call within the, so you are in the UK.
Yeah.
But you're on, you know, 3, 6, 24 hours standby sort of thing. So ultimately three tours and then, kind of ended up going out with the guys as you would expect to anyway.
And can you tell us anything about them three tours? The kind of stuff you were doing,
three tours
really.
In a whole in terms of including the Marines, then the tour. So then serving with the guys, we were out there again and a lot of the operations were very fine-tuned. So there's always a reason for these operations. The intelligence is amazing in terms of what we have. Nothing gets signed off willy-nilly. It is very on point. And the amount of green lights and steps you have to go through for these things to get actioned are unbelievable. So it's nothing, you know, you see kind of crazy things on the movies. It's not like that at all. You know, this isn't the Wild West when you head out there. Because I know there's things in the media that just can sound pretty barbaric. It's just not the case. And that's what I love about the UK. They stay stum. A bit like the Royal Family.
Yeah.
They don't get involved.
Yeah.
And they just let the noise kind of fade out. But that tour... Yeah, we were out there. I mean, I suppose talking about the operation itself, I can mention that, there was facilitators with IEDs recruiting individuals to kind of wear explosive vests. They were designing sticky bombs to stick on vehicles. They were quite quite adventurous in terms of their capabilities, quite advanced, I think. So we had to kind of neutralize or capture that kind of facility, if it were. And that night, it was just like any other operation. And even in that industry, it is sleep, eat, and repeat. And even that cycle, just to comprehend that as an outsider is crazy in terms of the pace of life. But it's just how you can perform and do it day in, day out is just unbelievable. None of these guys are drained. None of these guys are... fatiguing, maybe perhaps at the end of the tour, but they take all this into account. They're just machines, honestly. And it's so impressive when you're in that kind of fast pace of life and you're in that cycle just to see. And you all carry each other, you know. And there are times when you might be low down physically, mentally, and it's like, right, step out. And the leadership is just next to
phenomenal.
Yeah, so he's good.
So you go out on that night. Talk me through it.
Yeah, so that night, so you kind of get on the birds, as they say. You jump on the helicopters and we flew in that night. And we had to walk in. So I think it was around 7 kilometres. So you're all sat on the helicopters, it's quite cold, being December. And I have to say, you are laughing and joking before you kind of get on the helicopters. As boys are, you know, you're just joking around, banter. I'm messing around with the dog. And as soon as the birds come, as soon as you get on there, you kind of just switch. It's almost like you kind of fall into this character that you've been training so well. And things kind of do get a little tense and a bit serious, but that's just guys have different ways of kind of, you know, some guys will listen to music, some guys will just sleep, other guys will just like check their kit. Then you'll kind of get a five minute warning, and then that's it. That's, and as soon as you walk off the back, everyone is just so focused. There are no joking, there's no laughing. It's just like, this is it. We understand what has to be done, and the procedures you have to follow, and that is just, everything runs like clockwork. So walking in, stargazing. It's just a beautiful country, tranquil, quiet, can't make a noise, and sometimes you're lost in the moment. You know, on some of these jobs, you just like, it is surreal. Beautiful at times, but you just kind of, you're just so fixated. And then we work through the night, and it does, unfortunately, on this occasion, it did get kinetic, meaning there were rounds that were fired as we were clearing through kind of compounds and cave systems. And ultimately what happened, we cornered them. We kind of went down a rat run and, got into a firefight, which resulted in me getting hit. And as a consequence, I then had to find cover. It's really hard to explain being shot at the time, trying to process that. We're talking milliseconds now, waiting for maybe a follow-up.
Have you been hit once? Because you were shot 5 times in all.
Yeah, so if you ask Irene, just say 6, but he's counting. No, joking. So I took multiple rounds to my legs, one to the helmet, which ultimately I believe is the one that just floored me. MVG smacking my face and just pretty much, I had a few seconds there to kind of process what the hell just happened. Even though you're in a firefight, you're still trying to process that. So the next thing I'm thinking of, right, I need to get into cover, because if this guy then comes out of the cave, they potentially could kind of take my life.
Yeah.
So not knowing where the other guys are and what's happened to them, you get into cover and then you're trying to assess, you're trying to get into comms. My comms got knocked out of my ears. Luckily, I fell into some of the guys that we were with. And then I'm starting to check myself, because there is a kind of a magic window where you can ultimately bleed out. At this stage, I wasn't too sure where I was. I'd been hit. I couldn't feel my left leg. My knee pad was twisted, so I didn't know if my leg was broken. All I knew was my hip, because I tried to stand on my leg. The pain in my hip was crazy. So pulling down my trousers, assessing the situation, and, a minute had passed. I'm like, okay, this is great. You don't fall into that kind of, not coma, you don't fall into that kind of drowsiness, blood loss. And I'm like, okay, so, I think we're going to be okay in terms of, the initial timeline, the time frame you have to follow. And then my plan then was just to get down into cover and get assessed medically. But at this stage, the guys are doing what they should be doing and is taking care of the situation.
Okay.
Because ultimately poor people could get injured.
So you're out. You've made the decision.
I fell down. The guys then are doing their work. Yeah. And then this guy just dragged me all the way down the mountainside into a compound, and then literally one of the medics just jumped on me. I always remember, because we see things differently in them kind of situations. Time does slow down a little bit in a really bizarre way. But obviously I can't name names, but he could just hear this Brummy guy telling all these guys to F off, get into cover, because if a grenade goes off, we're all in trouble. And he all he remembered was just this Brummy guy. So he's just come walking over while he's controlling the situation.
The chaos.
Cool as a cucumber, kind of just gets his morphine pen out, sticks it in my backside. And then I'm just like, I'm like, high as a kite then. I'm just like, hey, let's go, And he's like, shut up, Jimmy. the guy's going to sort you out now. And he was just, but he was still, and this is what the training's about. He was still able to operate and deliver what he had to deliver. Whilst one of his guys had been hit, he was still able to carry on and kind of, and ultimately, whilst that firefight was going on, I got treated, I got CASEVAC'd out, the helicopters come in to pick me up. But that is, I know I kind of brush over it briefly, but it's just a really surreal place to be in.
Yeah.
But I don't give enough attention to the guys that, you know, were carrying me out. The medics, you know, they're still under fire. You know, they've still got to neutralize everything. They've still got to stop the carnage and control the situation now, yeah, because two of their guys had been hit. Yeah, and that to me is really impressive. Mm-hmm. That to me is the ultimate of what it means to be an operator of that, yeah, high caliber,
yeah,
to perform in their moments. And how, and it goes back to how do you train for that? Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean by the guys now, as we talk, they'll be training in scenarios very, very similar to that here in the UK.
Right now.
You know, so life can believe, you know, we could, I'm not saying we would lose life here in the UK, but there's a high chance of it.
Yeah.
Because we have to train as close to the real thing as possible. So, yeah.
And I've got to ask, what does that feel like when you're shot? What does that feel like? Like, because you just said then I didn't know where I'd been hit. I couldn't feel my left leg and I had a hip pain in my right hip. But what does it actually feel like?
Yeah, so it was automatic gunfire. So it's not like you see in the movies and they get hit and their body moves in weird ways and then they kind of go, oh, I've been shot, I'm coming to you. Like, and he gets up and like limps back, you know. I was blubbering like a baby, you know. No. I always say, I've never been hit by a bus, but I can imagine it was just, I was just floored. I was wiped out. You don't feel all the individual, like the one in my ankle. I mean, there's an X-ray of the round in my ankle. I didn't even know that until I was being assessed, and I could just see my ankle was my boot was full of blood. It was, and I'm like, bloody hell, I've been shot in the ankle as well. So I didn't even know that. Whilst the medics were kind of packing me with medical gauze, yeah, and filling the hole in my hip because my hip was shattered to stem the bleeding. I'm like, bloody hell. And then they're doing the assessment then and checking, saying, okay, yeah, there's one in the ankle, there's one in the calf, there's one in your, not the sciatic nerve, I didn't know, but now I understand, bloody hell, there's one in your back leg. That's why it went through the sciatic nerve, killing my leg completely. So yeah. I'm like, I can't feel this now, which was, that in itself, I still can't compute that sometimes.
Yeah.
Then the helmet, they're like, oh my God, you got hit in the head as well. And they're doing the assessment there, but that feeling, it's really is hard to describe.
Yeah. Because you've still got adrenaline running as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So I think when I got hit, training teaches us to get into cover. So I'm like, right, okay, you know, step one, get in cover. You know, step two, yeah, check yourself out. Step three, you know, call for mum. So, yeah, you kind of go through these steps that training has kind of ultimately, and I know it's easy to kind of talk about it a bit blasé, but you kind of just naturally fall into it.
Yeah.
You just automatically do these things, yeah, just like reacting to enemy fire. You kind of instinctively go through your drills.
As a family member, we couldn't have been more impressed. Like, we get the call on the 23rd of December. Mm. By Christmas Day, you are back. You're back in the UK. You're up in Birmingham. You're in Selly Oak Hospital, which isn't there anymore, sadly. Yeah. But you're there. And I think constantly being told where you were, when you'd be home, what was happening. You know, you talk about how proud you are of the service, and I think you're absolutely right. They really did look after you.
Yeah.
You were home within the blink of an eye.
Yeah, absolutely. So whilst being flown back, the RAF actually held that flight for me. It was the last flight out of theatre for a week. Because it was Christmas leave,
so
they held it for like 12 hours, and they're like, right, come on, we you know, we need to get out of here before the window shuts.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so they did. They held it for us.
That was so good.
What else was there? And then on the flight, sorry, I was going to be a bit emotional. Yeah. So on the flight, they actually let me call my wife, which was really bizarre because like, there was another guy with me and he was like, Jimmy, just go to sleep, will you? And just stop. And I'm going, I'm just talking. I'm on morphine. I'm out of it. Like, and I'm pretending that all was okay. Like, really bizarre. So I'm in and out. And then the guy said, look, do you want to call your wife? And, I was mega impressed because I thought I remembered a mobile number, but it wasn't that sort, you know. So obviously through the chain of command, they made the call. And so I'm talking to Irene and she's like, oh, look, they've picked me up. Driving to, you know, Birmingham, and I'm like, yeah, it's all good. You know, it's just a scratch. I'll be back in no time. And I was like, shut up. You know, like I said, look, please don't worry. I'm good. Just I'll see you in Birmingham.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was really impressed with that. You had the understanding that they could talk and communicate. Because it's not an interesting fact, when something happens in theatre around the world, all communications shut down until the families are told, because they don't want that
getting out
in the wrong manner.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. You'd only been married 6 months. You were married in the July and then got yourself shot in the December.
You know what? I got hit. And I do remember thinking, I can't go out this way. I mean, how bad is that? I can't do this to Irene. This is mental.
Yeah.
You know, being married,
a blink of an eye.
It was nuts. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that, like in that moment thinking, oh my God. And then the whole, the machine of the military just take over and you're just cocooned then and you're gone, which is great. You know.
And then they continued, to look after you, because the care that you then got, the rehabilitation that you then went through to learn to walk, really, to really strengthen all of your lower body, was phenomenal.
Yeah.
How long were you then in rehab for?
So I was in rehab for over 3 years.
Yeah.
So I was in a wheelchair for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
The only thing I could really do was hydrotherapy. So in a hydrotherapy pool with a nice sexy waistband done and like running in water. I mean, the first time to run again in water was mental,
really?
Like emotional. The feeling was just great.
Yeah.
Hence probably why Poseidon was born.
Yeah, sort of thing.
It was part of it.
Yeah.
But I was on the back end of that whole tour. So it was a fine, well-oiled machine in terms of the amount of individuals that had gone through it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So by the time I got there, and at first when I wheeled myself into Headley Court, which is the Defence Rehabilitation Centre down London, which is now moved up north, I kind of wheeled myself in and I'm like looking around and there's limbs missing, there's stroke victims, there's car accidents. And I'm like, and I said to Anna, I said, look, so we went back out to the car park and I'm like, I'm not having a meltdown. I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I'm Jimmy Hill. I don't need this. I'm okay.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. I didn't understand the severity of my injuries, really. I'm just like, you know, we're going to be all right, sort of thing. And it wasn't until I got into rehab, I'm like, oh my God, I've got so much to do here. And it's having that network and trusting the system that's been there for us.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that was amazing. And then I have to say the charities, we get pampered. We really do. Wrong word to probably use, but we get spoiled. And part of that is keeping us mentally stimulated as well, in terms of keeping us in that community is really important. And the charities recognise that, the military recognise that. But actually, it's the warrior spouses. And that terminology I got from America, it's the women. And again, the reason I say the women is because the Royal Marines at the time, it's just all men. So it's not like a sexist thing. So it was the women that actually are the foundation behind these incredible men, you know, at the time. And I just think that they got round Irene really well. And if they're supported and the family supported, then actually I can concentrate on my rehab. I don't have to worry about them as well. So that was great.
That was so important.
So my rehab then was just like,
Because that's the thing that I'm sure lots of people listening to this, where is the support for Irene? You know, she's a new bride. Her husband's just been delivered back to her in pieces. Where's the support there? But of course she did get so much support, which was
I think it's really hard, because within trauma there's pain physically, mentally, and I think the clarity is not there to understand the processes. So some of the charities do get backlash and people do get upset, and I mean, I know I could pick up the phone now and people would argue my point, but ultimately when you look at maybe I can't say the NHS, but when you look at certain systems out there, if you were in a car crash and you didn't have that support network, you are going to be in a pretty bad way.
Yeah.
You know, that support network, no matter how, and it is, a lot of it is what you put into it. They like dealing with the paras and the Royal Marines is because their experience of it is they're like driven to get back.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the whole army, you know, the Army, Navy and RAF aren't like that, but they just had, the guys had the drive to think, right, let's get back to fitness and then we can see if my career is still there.
So
they like that.
Yeah. Having been through all that, if you could have gone back into battle, gone back to special forces, would you have done?
I would have, yeah. So the hardest choice I had to make is, I knew my career was over, Christmas Day, lying there, and I'm like, you know, I look like, is it Octavia with all the tubes coming out my legs. I'm like,
it was pretty bad.
I don't even know what to do here. Like, yeah. This is nuts. So I'm on the iPad just scrolling, read, or, you know, looking for jobs. I'm like, helicopter pilot. I'm like, academically, not chance. You know, like, and I'm like, how do I match this? And where do you go from here? And I didn't have a clue.
Do you think, had you been physically fit and able to go back, that you would have had the same composure that you did have through your 10 years of service, having been shot? Does the training extend to that, to be able to, for you to deal with being shot and then returning to battle?
Yes.
Oh, it does.
I believe it does, but everyone is different. Yeah. I know loads of guys that I've actually spoken to about my next journey, my next chapter, and there's a lot of guys that have got fragged.
What does that mean?
So if an explosion's gone off, pieces of the explosions might hit them in the arm, fragments, or, you know, might go in the leg or something like that. And then I know guys that have been shot in the calves, and they carry on to have successful careers, and they still fight and they'll still go into battle. So yes, ultimately, you know, I know it ended my career physically, but there's guys that have gone through similar traumas and have continued.
Yeah.
Speaking to the Americans and the Australian guys, them too have kind of continued. I just felt that every time I went into the gym, you know, my story was kind of being developed into, how are you, how are your legs, you know, how are you feeling, how's your rehab? And I'm like, I don't want to be remembered for this. I don't want to.
Yeah.
And because I was, what, around 20, 30, 4, 5 at this stage, I'm like, you know what? I'm kind of young enough to try something. So I thought, let's just go. This is my chance to kind of get out on my terms, perhaps.
Yeah.
What's really hard is when the decision's made for you. The decision was made for me, so it's easier for me.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's. And that leads into that transition bit. Yeah. But I think I would like to think that I would go into battle, and it all comes down to the guys that you're with. I mean, what I had was unbelievable in terms of, just in them split seconds, they were on me.
Yeah.
They looked after me, putting their lives in danger to look after me.
Yeah.
That's just incredible.
Was there then a mental struggle when you realise Christmas Day and you're flicking through Reed, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to go back to that again? Because you'd been 14 years in the military. That's a long time.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know whether I used it as a natural, like, it was just a pregnant pause.
Okay.
And I'm like, I genuinely didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it was more about, how the hell do I pay this mortgage now? You know, I'm confident. And I know if I had said to the guys, look, give me a desk job, they would have said, bloody hell, Jimmy, you know, you've got experience that you can maybe pass on. Let's keep that knowledge within the unit, and we'll just stick you behind the desk and eat Jaffa cakes. You know, like, I'm certain, and I know they would have done that. But I just don't think that would have fulfilled me. Mm. I wouldn't have liked seeing the guys going out and kind of doing the job that we kind of joined to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I wasn't really emotionally upset about it. I wasn't frustrated. I think I was just so focused on my physical ability being taken away from him. I'm like, oh my God, I've got to get this physical, I've got to get back to fitness before I even start thinking about other things.
Yeah.
I mean, they told me I had to wait 2 years for the nerve stimulation to grow back, because I was hit so high up in my back leg, in my sciatic nerve. When I had a nerve graft, they said, right, the nerve takes a millimeter a day to grow back. You're tall. It was so high up. You know, you got 2 years before the muscles in your leg will die off, because when the muscles aren't activated after 2 years, they will just die off. I'm like, oh God, you know, like, so then I've got 2 years to wait and hang around.
To see what happens,
yeah. So then I know in my head, when they tell me that, I'm like, right, I can't do anything now for 2 years apart from rehab.
Yeah.
I am getting paid still, so that's kind of easy.
Yeah.
So actually, I think, you know, they mothered me, and I think that really did help for the family, myself, actually, just understanding the process. I knew the process I was in.
Yeah.
And I just accepted it straight away in a really,
Because now lies the transition. We talked about the transition from the couch to being a Marine and then Special Forces, but now we have the transition from being military back to Civvy Street again.
Yeah.
Was that difficult? Have you got there? Would you say?
I think it's, we just got to keep reflecting.
Okay.
We've got to keep looking back. I don't know if I am there. I don't believe the military make you who you are either. You know, there's times to say, you know, it's the military that make you who you are. I think, you know, you go into the military with a set of skills already that you don't know about. The military unlock them skills, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know, and they make you realize your potential. The transition's a hard one. I was a grey man at school even. And there was a comment on my report when I passed. You know, they always say, just be the grey man. Don't do too much, don't do too little. Just do what you're told and just get on with it. Don't show yourself up, or, you know, so just be a grey man. And I've always been good at that. And I've always kind of just, quietly assessed the situation without jumping in. And I think I've done that with the whole transition. And I definitely feel I'm still getting used to it. You do miss the brotherhood that everyone talks about.
Yeah.
But what I don't want to fall into is that's the be all and end all. I love to constantly remind myself about chapters. The military was a chapter and I'm now in a new chapter. And I want to enjoy the next 30, 40 years. I don't want to spend the next 30, 40 years kind of not moping around. That's really a bad word to use. But I don't want to think about it in that way, that negative way. Mm-hmm. I love the military. I would join the military again. I would do it all over. I would advise people to join the military, not my daughter, of course. You know, I think it's probably not going to be popular. But I think if you were to leave school, if you don't continue your education or you don't get an apprenticeship, you should probably look at national service for 2 years. Them three options for kids, I reckon, be amazing. And I reckon over 60% of people would stay in the military because of how good it is.
Yeah.
100%. And I know parents are like, oh, not a chance, but I honestly believe they would love it. They'd thrive.
It's interesting because even though you're not an active member, it's still a massive part of your life. Yes, you have the hydrotherapy centre and you're working with dogs, but you're also now heavily involved with documentaries, going all around the world, interviewing other special forces people that are in active duty or no longer in active duty.
No longer. Yeah.
What's so that been like?
That's been amazing. And literally around 2 years ago, I reached out to a friend and I said, look, I think it's the time. Maybe it's, you know, the itch again. Poseidon's okay and it's doing well. I'm enjoying it. And
but
I'm
you
like,
want the next challenge. Yeah.
So I think it was getting comfortable. And I'm like, you know what? I need to maybe put myself out there. And I always had this, going through Headley Court was really frustrating at times in terms of what you looking at other people's and how they were coping with their own their own journeys. Some of them really struggled. You know, they might blame the military, they might blame themselves, they might feel guilty, and I'm like, oh my god. So I got speaking to these guys and I said, look, we need to spread more awareness. There's something like over 65% of military leavers go on to have better lives, but you never hear about this. You always hear about the struggles.
The negative stories.
And I'm like, I understand the struggles. You know, we've been there on different levels and I get that. And then you've got that post-traumatic growth, which we need to talk more about. And you've got to go through them, you know, the whole PTSD structure to get that growth to then grow. And I met a lady and she actually turned around and said, your mess becomes your message. And I'm like, bloody hell. And that resonated with me. I'm like, that sounds really cool because everything I do is carnage.
Yeah.
No, you know. And now it's a message. No. But going to America, interviewing guys like myself that have had similar backgrounds, struggles with families, with service, injuries, has just been, one, it's been a therapy session for me, understanding that there are guys like-minded that go through the same situations. But also interviewing the specialists. For me, it's the wives and the specialists.
Specialists being what? Who?
People that specialise in psychedelics, perhaps, psychiatrists, strength and conditioning coaches, testosterone doctors, looking for treatments for the way we can treat alcoholism, depression, PTSD, TBIs, which are traumatic brain injuries. We're getting a better understanding of that every explosion that we've been close to is a shockwave in the air, which is air pressure that goes through the brain and it causes these like little shrapnels to kill off. It kind of kills off cells in the brain. And you've got billions of them anyway.
Yeah.
But there's more evidence now around that. So it's understanding it and actually where we're going with the whole documentary is storytelling with innovation of this kit that saved my life. So actually going out to these military companies and saying, look, I want to showcase what your kit does because I know ultimately it's saving my friends. And I love that.
Yeah. That is so powerful. By talking to all those people that you're interviewing for the documentaries, is there a theme that comes up time and time again?
You know what? There is. I think... oh, God, it's hard actually thinking back. I get emotional about it.
Really?
It's so bizarre.
Why is that? Can you just tell me why that is?
I think it's maybe not reliving it, but I think, I don't know if part of it's joy or the acceptance that these guys shared their stories to what ultimately is a stranger, you know, and they're being so open.
Yeah.
But the common theme is they're showing their most vulnerable sides, and you're talking about some of the hardest men in, you know, some of the most elite people on this planet, like, period. And for them to open up is just... it's crazy, I think, you know, to just expose themselves, not only that to somebody, but actually to broadcast it in a way that's therapeutic for them, but they want to get this message out to help. So for me, the message is patience is one that kind of comes on. The one is to assess accountability of your own actions and decision making when you look back and accepting that accountability for some of the decisions you made.
Yeah.
And the guys are really good at that. Like, some of them might be dependent on alcohol. They know it's wrong. And then they kind of accept it and apologize for it and understand it and then take action and look at substance abuses maybe and look for treatments. So the only way we can truly learn and develop, and people see this as a weakness, but it's a strength, I honestly believe, is opening up to individuals like-minded. But there's so many people that are suffering, and I will go into a statistic that will blow your mind in a very sad way. 9/11, everyone knows about 9/11, pretty much kicked off the war. So that time frame from when 9/11 happened to today, the Americans lost around, I think it's 9,000 troops, you know, 8 to 9,000 troops in combat, out in theatre, which is a massive number over that period of time.
Yeah.
That same period of time, they have lost 140,000 veterans to suicide. And I'm just like, when the guy said that to me...
That's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah. That gets me every time. Mm. Luckily... here in the UK, it's not the same.
Really?
I should take a minute.
Yeah, take a minute, of course.
Oh, I didn't expect that. so I don't know whether we're doing something different here in the UK.
I was just going to say, what is it that we're doing different? Do you think we've maybe got a lot more aftercare?
It's got to be something with the childhood. So when speaking to the specialist, and this is what I love, there's a guy called Chris Frew. He lives in Hawaii. He's called The Operator Syndrome. It's his book. And it's a playbook almost. So it kind of gives you a little snippet of certain conditions. So sleep deprivation is one of them. And you read his book and it will go into it. It will give you examples and it will say, look, have you tried this sleep hygiene? Very basic stuff. But it's a playbook and it breaks it down for you. And ultimately it was based around the SF community in America. But actually when you look at it, people that work for the NHS can look at it. The police, I feel sorry for the police. You know, they wear the same uniform on our streets. You know, we wore a uniform out in Afghan, come back, and we wore normal clothes. You know, so the police potentially have it harder than us in terms of coping mechanisms and stress. So operator syndrome was really good to kind of break that down, and I enjoyed that. The veterans out in America are leading the way with these conditions and treatments, and they're being very vocal and open about it. And some of them get criticised for it, and that's what winds me up when you look at and listen to them statistics.
Yeah.
It kills me.
It's interesting because when I asked you the question earlier about the different relationship with your brothers to your brotherhood, one of the examples you gave was that you are really vulnerable with each other, you know, at those quiet moments, you know, late at night or whatever, or when you're just, you know, in a place that's quite dark, mentally dark, that you will help each other. You'll be able to be vulnerable. And ironically, what you're saying is that if they were more vulnerable, actually, it's kind of therapy. It helps to just be more open about how they are, how they're feeling, that potentially 100%. It could reduce that horrendous statistic.
Honestly, I think about our family, you know, and I think, bloody hell, if we were more open and it is, it's been honest, it's been brutally honest, and the guys are brutal to the point where you feel sometimes that not you could be attacked in terms of their brutal honesty, yeah. but you've got to own it and you've got to trust it. And it's the speed that you have to do these things. And I reckon people that find their way out, whether it is through meditation, singing, poetry, psychedelics, physical activity, which is, you know, getting out into nature, you know, there's something there for everyone. But I yeah. think you have to revisit that pain, you know, physical, mental pain, and look at it from different avenues. You've got to get other people to say, Jimmy, you were wrong. Look at it from this point of view.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
And that's what I enjoyed with this documentary, being exposed to these guys and them opening up. And then hearing it from the wife's point of view, I'm like, oh my God, for a wife to talk his husband out of suicide, to cross the hallway and do homework with their kids in the same moment. I'm like, how do you compute?
Do you do that transition?
How do you do that as a wife? Yeah. And that's why I think the wives, I believe, have it harder.
Yeah.
I do believe they have it harder. And there's evidence out there to see it's not PTSD, but there is a second kind of secondary PTSD that they potentially could have
yeah.
in terms of kind of keeping such a stiffer upper lip. They're holding everything together.
Yeah.
So I admire them for that. And there are charities out there doing some good things for families and wives, and so they should. Because honestly, when we're serving and we're out there doing our thing, it's easy. Sleep, eat, repeat, and we're just doing it.
Name
robots.
Yeah, name some of those charities. Because I know since you've got better, physically better, you have done so much for charity.
Yeah.
I mean, you've done marathons, you've cycled. Tell me about some of the things you've done.
Yes. Oh, my God. So, yeah, the last one was the London Marathon. Yeah. I mean, to have an orthotic brace that I have to run with,
that's
ultimately. I can only do it on a treadmill because of the way it's designed.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to do something. So, yeah, there's charities like Blesma, which is a limbless association that you can kind of get in contact that will really support you. The British Royal Legion are amazing too. Help for Heroes is a big one that a lot of people know about. Rock to Recovery is another one that has opened. It's a lot of these charities now, which is really good, is they're opening their doors to the NHS and Blue Lights, so the police and fire brigade.
That's so
because,
good.
Because, you know, stress, we all deal with stress, and it's all the same stuff, different mechanics, but it's the same way in terms of we deal or don't deal with it. You know, does that make sense?
So
Rock to Recovery, we interviewed a guy who was, again, very close to suicide. He, I don't know how much I can say without saying his name. He became so used to seeing something that he made in his kitchen from a suicide point of view that it just become like a clock hanging in the wall.
Goodness.
And that was a noose.
Goodness.
And I'm like, oh my God. So when we spoke to Foxy, he kind of was telling us about his charity and the amazing work that guy's done is unbelievable. And the individuals he's helped and saved, I would say. One of the guys I was injured on that night, he actually was there. Such a great guy. And he actually, through his tour, he had a couple of struggles and he actually went to Rock to Recovery. And Rock to Recovery sorted him out and really helped him just process the information.
Yeah.
And I think what happens with the transition is you end up on your own ultimately, which is normal, and we have to accept that because ultimately you can't be with that community forever.
Yeah.
And I think that's when you start asking questions. So these charities are there to support.
Yeah.
But we are so crap at asking for help. So bad. We don't want to ask for help. We don't want to ask for money, you know, to buy a new brace, or, you know, we almost got to get a friend to do it for us and say, oh, get this guy a bloody brace, will you? Because you won't ask for it. And the charity's like, oh, bloody hell, we didn't know. 100% we'll do it.
Yeah.
And we just need to get better at that. And I think that's when I say we've got to be more open and honest with each other.
Mm.
But
do you think if you do ask, is there enough support out there? Is there enough help?
Yes.
Yeah.
There is enough help. And again, it's really touchy subject, you know, depending who you talk to.
Yeah.
But there is enough help. From my point of view, I mean, the Royal Marine Charity are amazing at actually keeping that community together. They are. I mean, for them, in terms of people watching how they do things, their community is just superb in terms of keeping the community going after service.
Yeah.
So Royal Marine Charity is great. The Benevolent Funds with the Royal Marines, the RAF have it, the Navy have it, the Benevolent Funds, the Not Forgotten Association, Emma Willis, she's a designer. She designs shirts. So I got a free, you know, suit shirt of her. Just, I mean, to her, it's kind of nothing, but it's like a thank you. But to us, if you look the part, you feel the part.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't even have to be good at your job, but if you look good, you know.
Yeah.
No. So that's her way of contributing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, and there is so Scotty's Little Soldier. He's another one. I think they make little teddies, and it could be a picture of me on the teddy for the kids.
Yeah.
I think that's what they do.
Yeah.
So there's loads out there, but the support is there. And I think it's just knocking that pride. Just get that pride and just go and ask for help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you want, final question from me, how do you want your story that you've shared with me today to impact on others?
If there is any impact of this whatsoever.
There will be.
No, I think it's more to expose yourself, being honest with yourself. The choices we make are ultimately who we are. And I think that's the accountability. We have to own that, even if it is bad decisions or choices. So that accountability of our choices is key. But I would honestly open up. And if you see someone struggling, that's the big one, is sometimes we tend to think they will be okay, but ultimately reach out for them.
Mm.
And then the big one is just fire a text to somebody that you haven't spoken to for ages, just saying something like, how you doing, buddy? That can shift someone's mind. I think it's for like 3 days just by that simple text, knowing really? That someone's thinking about them just out of the blue.
Mm.
So you don't even think, fuck, I'm going to call Jimmy. He talks for half hour. I ain't got the time. Just say, hey, Jimmy, you fat knacker. Come on, how are you getting on, sort of thing? You know, like that, just a simple text. And it's kind of a buddy-buddy check. Yeah, so just a buddy-buddy check, just simple text, just get it out there. And I'm sure there's some sort of campaign out there that kind of states that. But yeah, just to open up more.
Open up
It's not a weakness.
Yeah.
Mm.
Thank you.